Akron and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. Coming up on 10 minutes after 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for The Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for The Morning Show also comes from Carthage College, which welcomes psychology professor and researcher Dan Simons for a public presentation today at 11:30 in the Neiman Theater Center. Professor Simons is the co-author of the best-selling book, The Invisible Gorilla. He'll be talking about the limitations of our ability to take in the world around us and our ability to construct accurate memories of what we experience. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm very, very excited about today's morning show on a couple of different levels. First of all, we have something really interesting to talk about, namely last night's third and final presidential debate between the two major party candidates, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, and about this overall presidential campaign, which has been waged in ways that are, at least to some extent, unprecedented, or at least they feel unprecedented. Maybe when we look a little closer into our own history, in fact, it isn't quite as unprecedented as all that. But certainly, we have seen and heard quite a lot that has been quite amazing, let's just say. And so we're going to be talking with two people about that today. And I'm also excited that for the first time in quite a while, we have One person from Carthage and one person from Parkside. And I always love these moments when those academic worlds, in a sense, intersect in this particular respect. So I'm really happy, first of all, to welcome back to the morning show Dr. John Bruning, who is Associate Professor of CDM, or Communication and Digital Media, at Carthage College. And he has team taught for the last dozen years or so with political science professor Jeff Roberg, a class called Campaigns and Elections. And in this course, they look back at the history of presidential campaigns in our country and some of the fundamental building blocks of the typical campaign, political campaign, and how elections are run. And then alongside that, also a sort of a running analysis of the presidential campaign being waged at that moment in time. So Dr. Bruning's been conducting that particular class all semester, and many of those students were gathered together last night to watch last night's debate. From UW Parkside, I'm so happy to welcome, I believe for the first time, Dr. Peggy James, who is the interim dean of the College of Social Sciences and Professional Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, and also the a professor of political science there. And she has been teaching a course, which is also part of kind of a campus-wide initiative, if you will, called the Election Experience. And it is sort of the fulcrum of what is really a wide array of campus-wide events designed around the election. And Dr. James, I just realized that we had trouble with that microphone yesterday, so I'm actually going to ask you to slip over to this chair, and I think then we're going to hear you loud and clear, so sorry about that. So first of all, Professor John Bruning, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thanks, Greg.
Hear you just fine. And Professor Peggy James, we welcome you as well.
Thank you.
Okay. And let me ask you one more time. We welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you.
Okay. I'm still not hearing you, actually. Let's pull that mic in front of you. Sorry about that, everybody. Okay. All right. Let her rip.
Thank you again.
There we go, loud and clear. Sorry about that. We have something amiss in a couple of the mics here in the studio. Now we have everybody on deck. Everybody is fully audible and happy about that. Yeah, that's right.
I'm sorry. Is my microphone on?
It's on, loud and clear. I promise. So great to have both of you here. And first of all, let's kind of talk about what an amazing opportunity it seems like it is to be teaching a course or coordinating programs in and around a presidential campaign as sort of electrifying as this one has been, at least in a lot of respects. I mean, I would just assume that it's, in a sense, a professor's dream to have a campaign that is, it feels like it's been waged unlike any other, certainly in our lifetimes. In fact, do you see it that way, as this kind of bonanza, this wonderful opportunity? Or has it, in a sense, been so atypical that it's maybe not helpful to the cause of helping your students understand what this process is all about?
I would start out by saying yes to both things. Is that it's been really exciting and helpful, and it's enervating to the campus to have people be a little bit more interested in a campaign that they might not have otherwise. However, in terms of our students, we also are seeing a little bit of a withdrawal from the process because of the fact that both candidates are, enjoying the lowest approval ratings in history. And so in some cases, it's good theater, but in another case, it's not very good politics.
Hmm.
Yeah. And Trump really breaks the mold in so many ways that I think it's been interesting for us this semester, because we do really, I think, go, as Greg kind of mentioned, we sort of look historically to think about kind of what happens in debates or traditions in advertising or whatever it is. Those are sort of the things that I focus on in communication. And so we tend to look at these things historically, and then kind of Trump comes along and really doesn't follow any of the historical models, I think, in a way. So it's good because it does provide us opportunities, I think, to show something which is so different than this sort of historical norm. So by seeing, you know, we're talking about announcement speeches, for example, and we showed Hillary Clinton's announcement speech when she announced her candidacy. And we talked about, you know, what they traditionally do in those kind of speeches, and hers was very traditional. It was like, you know, looking over New York Harbor and, you know, great patriotic flags in the background. And then Trump comes down his elevator. His escalator in Trump Tower, and, you know, really starts to kind of go on this sort of policy-oriented rant, which was very different than kind of the sort of historical message that you see. So it can be really illustrative, I think, to kind of say, okay, here's how it's historically happened, and here's what Trump tends to do. But I feel sometimes like I'm being more critical of Trump just because he is so outside the box that I'm trying to, you know, saying, okay, well, here's how it's traditionally been done, and here's how he's doing it. But I'm not necessarily being critical of that.
Right. I mean, you're not saying this is the right way to do it. Here's the wrong way that he's doing it. You're not trying to make that distinction, at least. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, there's probably a reason why it's been done this other way. And I suppose one of the most interesting questions is to untangle why Mr. Trump is waging such an unconventional campaign. And I'm not sure to what extent we even know the answer to that.
I think in some sense it might be that we need to look at the system as well, to look at why Trump is, first of all, emerging at all as being successful. Trump's not new. It's not as if Donald Trump is a new person on the scene. He's been involved in politics, even tried to make a little bit of a political run before. But it seemed as if the time was right for this kind of a candidate. So if we look at perhaps the possibility, is Donald Trump successful, as successful as he is, simply because there's a certain systemic atmosphere where people are rejecting the real political elitism of our political parties. And so he's successful because people are looking for something radically different than what we're used to. Mm. And so even when he says things that are surprising and perhaps not politically correct in some sense, there's a whole group of his supporters who are actually saying that's good. He speaks his mind. He's someone who actually tells it like it is. And so there's an atmosphere out there that makes it possible for him to do as well as he is doing.
Mm-hmm. And I think too, that sort of this, we live in this sort of reality TV age too. You know, I think that our expectations maybe of public figures, and he's obviously somebody who blends those two worlds, or sort of has a foot in each world, maybe in politics or reality TV. But I think that our standards of acceptable behavior are probably changing too. I mean, in addition to a lot of the things that you mentioned, I think just there's sort of a cultural moment right now, maybe where his kind of a candidacy makes more sense.
One thing, of course, I know that's of specific interest to you, Professor Bruning, not that you're not interested in this also, Dr. James, is the matter of television advertising, since you are in the field of CDM specifically, communication and digital media, and the fact that Mr. Trump has made the decision to not blanket the airwaves with television and ads the way every recent candidate before him has done. I mean, tapping their financial reserves right to the max to get as many commercials on the air as possible. He's chosen not to do that. Has a lot of analysis been done, as far as you know, about what is behind that decision? I mean, is he just being cheap, or is he being smart, or is he being both? I mean, what's going on there?
He's not known as cheap, generally. I think it's definitely a strategy that he has. I mean, he certainly has a lot of resources, financial resources, that he could be buying more advertising. But I think he's chosen, and I think it's partially he tends to use social media primarily as his method of communication with voters, as opposed to advertising as much. He's well known for his Twitter use. Mm-hmm. That's been a big kind of story, I think, throughout the campaign. And so I think he sort of feels like he can circumvent the traditional media, but also maybe not need as much advertising in order to get his message out. So I think that's a big part of what's going on. I mean, he is doing some ad buying now, I think, in some of the key battleground states and so forth. And obviously you have outside groups which are doing advertising too, so maybe the candidates now don't need to do quite as much from their own campaign coffers. More outside groups are also doing advertising for them or on their behalf. A lot of the attack advertising against Hillary Clinton has been done by various outside groups, I think, too. So there's a number of things, I think, that are at work there.
And early on, I think that he, and maybe even now, he's getting a lot of coverage just simply from the traditional media. And John Nichols was at Parkside a week ago, and he mentioned that there was a study done during the Republican campaign, the Republican primary, is that the traditional media sources gave 240 minutes of attention to Donald Trump as related to 1 minute for Bernie Sanders on the average. Yeah. And so that's a lot of free publicity in terms of name recognition and people sort of thinking that maybe, you know, he's the candidate to beat. But while I think that was probably very effective during the primaries, he's still getting that same sort of coverage, but it's more negative, and now there's more of a focus on just two candidates. So what really worked for him fairly well, I think, during the primaries might actually be backfiring a little bit during the actual last days of the campaign.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder, Professor Bruning, and I want you to weigh in too, certainly, Dr. James, if you have an opinion about the ads that have aired, I mean, both on behalf of Hillary Clinton and those that have aired on behalf of Donald Trump, how effective you think they've been, if you've seen anything that's been particularly effective, you know, and I'm asking you as someone who's involved, in a sense, in the creation of such things.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure how effective I really believe that political ads are anymore. I just think there's so many of them. There's so much saturation, depending on where you are, obviously. I was in Las Vegas recently, and there's a really competitive Senate race there. And so we turn on the TV, and it was just ad after ad after ad after ad. And it was just all political ads. And so I think when there is that kind of saturation, I'm not sure that one ad can really break through in that sense. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think I've seen some really interesting techniques. We're actually, for Family Weekend this weekend, we're giving a little talk about the presidential election at Carthage. It's Family Weekend. And that was one of the things I'm talking about, is some of the specific imagery that's being used in some of the attack ads, which I think is really interesting. You know, North Korea and ISIS, and, you know, there's a lot of those very strong images that they're using in the advertising. So, I mean, they're using some of the traditional strategies. I'm just not convinced really how effective they are, really, right, in terms of, or whether they have some of this kind of reverse impact too, you know, that it just absolutely turns people off to the process.
I absolutely agree with you, is that there's been a lot of research that's actually shown that negative ads don't help the candidate, that actually people don't turn their opinions over to the person who is targeting their opponent. So it doesn't work, for one thing, but the only effect that it seems to have is actually to turn people off from the election process itself, from the electoral system, to turn away from that entire aspect of voting or participating at all. So essentially, it seems like it's not really helpful to an individual candidate, and may actually hurt turnout, may hurt the people becoming disaffected from the system. And this is what research has shown, is that it's really been more effective in that manner than actually something that would be a political tactic for one candidate over the other.
For those of you just joining us on the morning show today, I'm really happy to have with us, first of all, Dr. Peggy James, Interim Dean of the College of Social Sciences and Professional Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, where she is also a professor of political science. And with us as well, Dr. John Bruning, who is Associate Professor of Communication and Digital Media, or CDM. And each of our guests are teaching or team teaching courses at their respective campuses that, to one extent or another, are following this current presidential campaign. Of course, one of the reasons both of you are here this morning and not tomorrow morning or yesterday morning is because last night was the third and final debate. So first of all, describe the events which occurred at your respective campuses and maybe what's happened at the previous debates as well, in terms of how you have treated these debates as learning experiences for your respective students. Professor Bruning.
So at Carthage, we've had watch parties for the debates, essentially. Professor Jeff Roberg in political science and I, as Greg mentioned, teach this campaigns and elections course. The first debate actually happened during our class. So we did have a campus-wide event, and we had probably about 100 people or so, I think, that attended that first debate. We did not have an event for the second debate, but then had one again last night for the third. And last night, I guess, there was about 30 students that showed up. So just like the, I guess, just like the TV audiences, maybe the student audiences were slightly less interested this time around. But we do like to have something on campus where students can get together and watch the debate and really have a discussion about the debate. So our general policy is we just watch the debate. Immediately after the debate, we turn off the television, and then we have a discussion about what went on, trying to eliminate the influence of pundits. You know, what did the professionals think about the debate? What did, you know, the people on CNN think about the debate? But what do you think happened in the debate? So we have some pretty interesting discussions based on that. We try to take a little poll about how many Democrats and Republicans we have in the room, and then also about, you know, who they think won the debate. And so we always kind of try to measure that a little bit and then get them talking about some of the things that stuck out for them. Or last night, I think they talked a little bit, too, about kind of how any of the topics applied to them or were important to them as college students. So we kind of try to emphasize some of those issues as well.
Very good. Professor James?
At Parkside, the debates are part of the larger election experience. And so Dr. Christopher Hudspeth, who team teaches the class with me, also hosts all debates. We've had debate watches for the three presidential debates and the vice presidential debate. And it's interesting comparing this to what we did the last time the presidential election occurred. We had a large number of people in the beginning. And then it sort of dwindled, and we had not a very good turnout for the vice presidential, which is, I think, what we anticipated. But this year has been, I think, a little bit different. The second presidential debate that was on Sunday.
The town hall.
Yeah, that was during the Packer game as well. I went off to the debate watch and said, well, I don't think there'll be very many people there, maybe just me and two or three other people. But I said I'd be there. And we had 40 people, 40 students returned, which I think is actually quite a lot of students on a Sunday evening during a Packer game. And I was a little surprised at that turnout. Last night we had a really good turnout, a little over 60 people, and which also was different than the last time we actually did this. So it's a little bit of a different pattern. What we do during the debates is we open up a live chat room so that students can participate and comment and discuss issues and topics and statements as they occur. And this is done with a screen where other people who aren't participating can actually watch it. But people can also participate whether or not they're actually in the den at the debate watch or they're doing it at home. But most people are actually sitting there with us. So we have a constant stream of discussion and activity and comments going on during the debate where people are commenting on statements and what they're thinking about how the candidates are doing.
That's a really great idea, I think, you know, so that, and it also kind of maybe provides some anonymity for them, I think, you know, because politics are always sort of difficult to discuss, whereas if you take it and put it in that more online environment, that might kind of motivate people to participate.
I think that's actually really true, is that there's a lot of people who wouldn't necessarily raise their hand or say something. But online, especially if you're using an avatar or something else, is that you can say, you know, pretty much what you're really thinking without people necessarily coming at you. And it's monitored, so we monitor it and make sure that things don't get out of hand. But they haven't this year at all. And it's been really interesting that most of the comments have been not necessarily for one candidate or against another candidate, and that's different from 4 years ago where it was really political, that one candidate was saying something bad and the other one was not. This year, it's been really even-handed in terms of critiquing what each candidate's been doing. So it hasn't really been what I would say is really partisan. It's been more of just a constant critique about the entire process.
Wow. And maybe things like, how is this person communicating their ideas, whether or not I agree with them? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
I'm kind of amazed to hear you say that. I mean, amazed and heartened that there's somebody in America right now who can watch a debate like that, in a sense, somewhat dispassionately, because I don't think there are too many people like that. Does that sound familiar to you, John?
Yeah, it's difficult, I think, you know. But I think there has been, I think this year, a lot of like you're saying, sort of criticism of both sides. Mm-hmm. That seems to be a position I see a lot in students. Maybe, I don't know if that's true of the public mm-hmm. in general, but just mm-hmm. sort of the tone of these debates, I think, has been so striking that maybe it's less about issues and more about, you know, who's interrupting who and who's stalking who and, you know, who's being more impolite and those kinds of things.
Right, or who's answering the question, that
yeah,
kind of thing.
Right, too. Right. Those kinds of things. The more sort of less so maybe about the issues themselves, although clearly there are issue differences too, but it is sort of something that I think we've seen in our own discussions too, is that a lot of it is about what's happening in the debate as opposed to, you know, the real differences in issue positions.
Right. You know, what that reminds me of is one of the first presidential debates I remember watching way back in ancient history when the Democratic candidate was Walter Mondale. So would that have mm-hmm. been against Ronald Reagan? I think.
Yeah,
I'm not sure about that. But anyway, sorry, I don't mean to, I'm not trying to put you guys on the spot, but I'm what I'm remembering is Barbara Walters hosting one of those debates. And I so vividly remember her at the end of each of the candidates responding, basically saying, and for the record, neither candidate answered my question. And I just remember just feeling shocked that how could this be that Barbara Walters could ask a question that neither candidate would answer. And I'm not even sure at the time I was aware that either of them had been particularly evasive, but as far as she was concerned, they were. But, you know, to me, that was, and maybe to other viewers, I don't know, it was like a shocking moment. And now, I mean, that's not even remarkable, let alone shocking. It really kind of says something about where we've come and sort of the tenor of these debates to where they've come by this point in time.
Now it's not so much a shock as it is a tradition, I think. And this is something we've seen at Parkside as well, and maybe I'd really be interested if it's happening at Carthage, is that there is a much increased interest in third-party candidates. Mm-hmm. And in terms of Jill Stein or Gary Johnson, is that this time, during the last presidential election, it was really just focused on the two candidates, whereas this fall, we're really talking more, at least the students are talking more about our third-party candidates and our options and having the third-party candidates be in the debates, essentially systemic or process-oriented criticisms.
Interesting.
Yeah. I think there has been a little bit more attention in the third-party candidates. Maybe haven't seen so much of it among the students, but there certainly is some of that there, I think, yeah. Mm. And I think, you know, going back to what we were talking about before in terms of the moderators, I think the moderators really have a lot more power or agency now than they used to have. You know, it seems that the kind of the format where the moderators are allowed to follow up on questions a little bit more than they used to be, I think. When we had sort of the panel discussion, you know, a lot of the early debates were sort of panel moderated and those kinds of things, where now it seems like there's built into it a little bit more interaction. I'm not sure that we get better answers or that they're answering the questions any better than they were in the past, but I think now at least it's built into the debates themselves that there is the ability for the moderator to say, okay, well, but you really didn't answer the question. A little bit, I think you saw that a little bit in the second debate where Anderson Cooper was challenging Trump on the tapes and whether or not he understood what the charge was and whether or not he had engaged in any of that behavior or just talked about it. I think he was able to kind of follow up in a sense and really hold him to it, although he still gave a pretty evasive answer.
Right, but in other words, the debate itself is less scripted and in a sense a more organic, dynamic event than they once were, where you had a piece of paper, it had questions on it, you asked these questions, and then the candidate said what they were going to say.
And the time limits were a lot more strict before, I think, where there'd be, you know, you'd get 2 minutes for a response, and then
and it was 2 minutes.
Right, and then the next candidate got there, you know. But now there's this kind of, okay, you each get 2 minutes, but now, then there's this discussion period after, which is sort of unstructured. So that really, I think, changes the nature of the debate. People were frustrated, I think, with those two-minute answers, right? I mean, the debate is the one chance that we get to actually hear the candidate speak unfettered, right? Mm-hmm. They're not giving a stump speech. They're not it's not a soundbite. So, I mean, I think people want more depth, but I'm not sure that these follow-up these kind of unstructured things are really giving us that, or they're just giving us more combative. You certainly hear the candidates, you know, talking over each other all the time.
Right. And I think to some extent it allows for that to become a tactic in terms of the debate, and I'm sure you probably know more about this than I do, but it's been suggested by some people that the actual interruptions or the talking over is an attempt to muddle what the other candidate is saying, to sort of keep them from getting to that final punchline when they're leading up to it, and you interrupt them, and then people say, what did he say? What did she say? And so that becomes a tactic in terms of interruptions.
Hmm. One thing I'm really curious about with both of you, with your particular students and your interaction with them during this election season, is there's certainly a fair amount of conversation about the intractability of quite a lot of people in the electorate at this point who are adamantly committed to voting for Hillary Clinton, or adamantly committed to voting for Donald Trump, and there is very, very little that either candidate could possibly say that would sway them. And then, of course, there are undivided, uncommitted voters or waffling voters in the middle, but there are quite a few people that are really kind of calcified in their positions, in a sense. Amongst your students, with whom you're interacting in this course, how would you in general gauge where they are at in terms of their, let's say, level of malleability? Are most of them at least relatively entrenched in whatever position they are right now?
I think we actually asked this question yesterday at the debate, and asked the people, you know, sort of whether or not they thought this was truly going to be a fact-finding, decision-making night, or whether it was going to be something that was simply a rally around a person's candidate and be just sort of just another pep rally. And all of our students there agreed that it was the latter, and that essentially people had pretty much made their mind up by now. And it's interesting in terms of these debates, and we talked about this last night, is that over a third of the voting population has already voted in terms of early voting.
Already now?
Yes.
Oh, I hadn't heard that.
Yes. Excuse me. So approximately, and this comes out of a Florida project run by a political scientist who looks at early voting trends, and approximately 34% have already voted in states. And all but 13 states in the country actually allow for this. Three states actually run their entire election process by mail. And so a lot of people have already done this. The Clinton campaign is estimating that up to 40% of people have already voted.
Wow.
So you look at just that general statistic, and that means that yesterday's debate was perhaps a lot less effective than
right.
you might have thought.
Kind of beside the point.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
wow, that's really, really interesting.
Yeah, and I think that the research tends to show, too, that these things don't tend to move the needle in terms of really changing people's right. opinions, that generally people, it just sort of reinforces what people already think.
Right.
You sort of see what you want to see in those debates, I think, to a certain degree. I mean, there are obviously undecided voters, and we have some in our classes and in some of these forums that we've had that are undecided and are still making up their mind, I think. So I think there are a few of those, but I think that, as you're saying, you know, there are probably fewer and fewer of those. And whether these really have an influence on how they vote is less clear.
Right. It was CNN's John King last night who said, I thought he phrased it very well when he said, in terms of what Donald Trump needed to do last night, he basically said Donald Trump needed to bend steel, and he didn't, meaning that Donald Trump needed to do something quite dramatic in terms of turning around what really are sagging numbers just about across the board. And of course, at least in his opinion, and in the opinion of a fair number of people, he didn't necessarily do that. It seemed like he was speaking to his own base, which is, you know, a perfectly valid choice to make, but that, in fact, in terms of reaching out to some of those undecided voters and trying to snatch some of them in his direction, he perhaps did not achieve much in that respect last night. I wonder if that is your impression as well in terms of how he conducted himself last night.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think he's had a bad couple of weeks, right? So, I mean, there's relatively few opportunities for a candidate to really turn it around, and the debates are one of those opportunities, which are, you know, with only a couple of them, with three of them happening, they really have to use those. If in a position like he's in right now, he really had to use that, I think, to really turn it around in some significant way. And I'm not sure that I saw that last night in terms of anything. It seemed like the most noteworthy story that came out of the debate was, in fact, maybe harmful to him, which was this story about whether or not he was willing to accept the results of the election and whether he felt like he was willing to do that or not. That seemed to be the headline out of it. And so that, to me, you know, that may play well to, like, his base, potentially, I suppose, but maybe not. And I would think, so in terms of doing anything that was going to really affect the outcome of the election, I think that was probably not there.
And I would agree as well. I think that this third debate for Donald Trump was probably his worst in terms of performance. There were some mixed results in the first and perhaps even more mixed results in the second. But last night, he did not bend steel. I don't think he could crumple paper last night in terms of making that effect. But I also agree with John is that what he did do was he made a comment that really reached the news this morning, and that was his refusal to say that he would accept the results of the election. And I think that is his big mark for that particular debate. And my colleague, Dr. Hudspeth, has said that it's really not so much the actual debate itself, but it's what gets reported the next day in terms of what, because there's a lot of people who don't watch the debates, but they will listen to the sound bites or the reports for 2 minutes the next day. And that's been what's on the news this morning.
Right.
And I was going to say, historically, that's been true, too, right? That in debates, when we think back historically about debates, it's usually one thing that somebody said or did that we tend to remember. You know, George Bush looking at his watch.
Right, or I knew John Kennedy. He was a friend of mine. You're no John Kennedy.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, it's those.
Or there you go again.
There's a whole list, a hit list of things that have happened in debates. But you're right. I mean, that's what people are going to remember, not all the nuance of what happened or the polypsy positions. It's going to be something that, you know, was striking and was reported the next day. And that seems to be the report coming out.
Right. And, of course, not just reported the next day, but for people who did watch the debate, for instance, I watched it on CNN, and that is what their analysts pounced on. And so for somebody who was watching the debate and just kind of taking it in and maybe trying to figure out, you know, so what was the big moment in this? I mean, they're sort of told what the big moment was in what you just saw. The most interesting comment I heard from somebody about that comment was the idea that that was perhaps the worst thing that Donald Trump could have said in terms of his own prospects, because it would perhaps have the effect of suppressing his own base from getting out and voting. If you continue to stoke this idea, this notion that the whole thing's rigged, it probably makes it a bit less likely, at least for some people, to even bother to vote if the whole process is rigged in that respect. I'd never stopped to think about that, but I think that's a perfectly valid interpretation of some of the potential consequences of saying that.
It certainly could be.
I think that Donald Trump supporters are going to vote regardless. The people who've decided they're going to vote for Donald Trump are going to make a statement and they're going to vote. And I think the ones that really are more likely to stay home are the ones who are rejecting both candidates. And so these are the people that might be the undecideds right now. I think the undecideds are not sure if they want to vote at all or if they want to vote for a third-party candidate. And if they decide that that third-party candidate has no choice, has no chance either, they might not vote. So I think the people that really are going to stay home are the ones who have been completely turned off by the entire by the array of choices that they have.
I think, you know, we've been talking a lot in our class about the symbolic value of a lot of these political events, you know, that like the debates, for example, they have this instrumental value, right? They're great voter education tools, but they also have this symbolic value that, you know, the two candidates can be in the same room. They can discuss things without, you know, getting physical, something like that, right? So it sort of affirms our democratic traditions. And so I think that that piece of it is what really struck me, was that he wasn't willing to kind of take that symbolic step that essentially every candidate is, as they were saying, I was watching a little of that CNN coverage last night too, and they're saying, well, for 200 years, we've been willing, every candidate basically has been willing to do this. And so I think that was the thing to me, at least, that was most striking about that moment in the debate, that it really kind of stepped on that symbolic tradition that we have.
And just to be devil's advocate, though, on this, so it does speak to the people who actually support Donald Trump, to the people who say that the entire political system is elite-based and that and there's a certain population that I think is still recovering from the recession, where they're feeling that they had to give up a lot, and especially perhaps positions of privilege that they thought they had before. And so even his willingness to say that what we have up till now considered to be sacrosanct is not. And so in some ways, although, as you say, I don't think he's widening his base on this, but he may actually even be speaking to his supporters who are already saying that, you know, politics is crooked and everything is sort of controlled by an elite group. And so by him coming out and saying that, I think there's a number of people out there who are his supporters who are probably saying, yes, you're absolutely right. And so reinforcing the base, but not expanding it, as you mentioned.
Do you find that rhetoric alarming, the way that some people do? I mean, in the sense that should the current numbers hold out and Hillary Clinton be victorious in November, then what does that mean if Donald Trump's so-called concession speech would in fact be a speech saying, I was robbed, this was rigged? What would that do to our country? I mean, there are some people who feel like we could be rent asunder by that, and then there are others who are saying that's not likely to have those kind of sort of deadly repercussions in terms of the health of our republic. What do you think about that?
I would say perhaps consider the source. Donald Trump has said a lot of things in this campaign that probably would not have happened even had he become president. I mean, he does seem to be a bit, from my perspective, a little bit loose with his words and casual with his statements and casual with his facts. So I think that looking at who's saying it, that perhaps we can discount the awful impact that you think it might have. It might have been a little bit different had Al Gore decided to sort of continue his questioning of who won the race when there was that tight race in Florida. He, of course, didn't do that. But I think we need to consider that Donald Trump, and Hillary said this last night, is that he accuses all sorts of processes as rigged when he doesn't win. And I think that was a really powerful statement, that if he didn't win an Emmy, the process was rigged. If he didn't do this or he didn't win something, then it wasn't a fair process. I think we need to consider that it's Donald Trump who's saying this.
Yeah. And I think, I would agree. I mean, I don't know what the real consequences of it actually are. But I mean, I think it's more of this kind of, again, I go back to this kind of reality TV candidate. You know, he said, I thought the way he phrased it last night was so interesting. You know, I'm going to keep you in suspense. You know, and I thought, wow, that is really an interesting way to say that. And it's almost like he's trying to get ratings or something, you know, I mean, more so than running for president. And so I agree. I think it's, as you say, maybe just the typical talk, the typical pattern of Trump, but also maybe just not understanding, you know, how that was going to play.
Mm-hmm. We just have a couple of minutes left to talk about any other moments in last night's debate that you thought were particularly intriguing, particularly interesting.
Yeah, I really thought the second debate was much more interesting, actually, than last night's debate. I mean, last night's debate was a little bit more traditional in format. I thought the town hall, partially because of the circumstances leading up to it, I thought really, in terms of the release of the tape and those kinds of things and the confrontation there, and the town hall format, which I think was even harder on Trump maybe than last night's debate. I don't know. I mean, I thought that he really, the way he just physically moved around the stage. A lot of the students' comments after that debate when we talked about it were about him sort of seeming menacing and it just like not really being able to address the people that were asking the questions and things like that. And I thought that for him was a more challenging environment than last night. Last night, I thought you know, he didn't have as many problems with the moderator and with the format and those kinds of things. I thought it was a little bit more traditional in that sense, and maybe no kind of home runs either way. But I thought the second debate was really important in terms of thinking about his image, at least from what I heard from students among the electorate.
What seemed to be the general consensus last night among the students was that this was perhaps the most measured and standard debate that we've had all throughout. Is that the first two were the first one was a little bit uncontrolled until the end, and then the town hall meeting was gloves off to a large extent, and there was a lot of manipulation, at least they identified, of the stage, especially by Donald Trump. If you looked at the camera angles, that wasn't allowed in this particular format last night. If you look even on CNN when they were televising it, it was just solely the candidates. They never even went to Chris Wallace, and so you never really got, and it was a split screen as well, so it just never went off of that split screen approach, and so I think in some sense there was less opportunity for perhaps manipulation of the stage. There was less opportunity for actually probably manipulation of the moderator. We did a flash survey and said who's winning the debate at one point, and it was the moderator. who was winning. At least that's what the students thought. And I think it was a much more measured and until the end when he made his dramatic statement about the electoral process, that it was probably more like a traditional debate than the other two had been.
I thought it was interesting, too. The other moment that sort of struck me was when they did those sort of impromptu closing statements. There really weren't closing statements built in, but he gave them each a minute to kind of sum up their case, and how at one point during that, Trump, you know, as he has been done sort of doing throughout the debates, interrupted her and said, such a nasty woman, right in the middle of her speech, which I thought was really an interesting moment. And I don't know if that was a gender issue necessarily or not, but I think that I hadn't really seen anything quite like that in a debate before. And so that was something, to me at least, that stuck out as something that was striking about last night's debate.
Yeah. I want to ask you in a final question, how difficult it is to teach a course like this and leave whatever personal preferences you have out of it. And maybe you don't. I mean, maybe that's impossible, or maybe that's inappropriate, or whatever you think. I'm really curious about that, though, in terms of, you know, particularly in an election like this, where I suspect each of you in your heart of hearts has a candidate you very much favor over the other. How do you handle that reality when it comes to, for instance, teaching a course like this, talking to your students, trying to offer clear-headed analysis of what's going on, what's being said, and so on?
We do try to remain neutral in our course. I mean, we really try not to let our own political affiliations slip at all, and it is difficult at times, you know. It's hard sometimes not to, and sometimes, like I think I mentioned earlier, I feel like a lot of times when I'm criticizing Trump, it's not a partisan criticism. It's a criticism that's based on, you know, the theory of, so for example, an announcement speech or what you do in a debate or those kinds of things. But I think I'm careful always to use the counterexample as well, so that it's balanced, right? So that even though we're being critical from a theoretical perspective or historical perspective, that we're not being critical from a partisan perspective. So that's really what we try to do.
And we also try to do the same thing at Parkside, to look at it as a process, as an engagement process. And indeed, the election experience really is, it's made a little easier for myself to be that way, because it's a campus-wide involvement. So we have people from all four colleges giving brown bags and presentations. So it's not just the class as much as the entire campus is involved. And as well, we really use the election experience as an opportunity to encourage citizenship among our students and engagement. So it's focused on the presidential election, but really the whole point of the process is to get students engaged, to be good citizens, not only now for the presidential election, but in their community, in their campus, in their involvement just in terms of their fellow citizenry. So we really do focus on that general aspect of citizenship.
I like that. Well, I certainly appreciate the fact that you've both made time in your busy schedules to join us for what I think has been a really interesting conversation. Dr. Peggy James, Interim Dean of the College of Social Sciences and Professional Studies at Parkside and Professor of Political Science. Great to have you here on the morning show for what I trust is just the first of many visits you'll pay to the program. And Dr. John Bruning, Associate Professor of Communication and Digital Media at Carthage. Great to have you back on the program. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on the morning show, no politics, just the Brahms Requiem. We'll talk to James Schatzman and Susan and Jim McKeever, who are going to be involved in two performances of the Brahms Requiem this weekend, one of the great masterworks in the history of music. James and Susan McKeever will be playing the two-piano accompaniment in an arrangement that they made. And Jim Schatzman, of course, is the conductor of the Choral Arts Society. So we look forward to that conversation on tomorrow's program. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College. Hosting today, Dan Simons, professor of psychology at the University of Illinois and co-author of the best-selling book called The Invisible Gorilla. His talk is this morning at 11:30 in the Neiman Media Theater. Support also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that